This is Alan Piggott, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 11th of June 2012. Alan Piggott, Part 1.
My name is Alan Piggott. The place is Doncaster. Do you want the place of birth?
Yes.
The place of birth was Bradford in West Yorkshire.
When's your birthday?
13th of March 1937.
So how old are you now?
75.
Still working?
Oh, yes.
Doing what?
Until November this year, I finally decided to retire. I do two jobs part-time. I work 27 hours a week, half of which is for Broadsworth Parish Council, for which I'm the clerk, and the other half is the clerk to the management committee of the community centre that I work for.
What was your father's profession?
Well, before he was injured, he was a baker, a journeyman baker, but he had an accident during the war that crippled one shoulder, and from then on he didn't work. He used to sit at the end of the passageway waiting for the postal order to come for his benefit. Rather sad. He was a nice man, but unable to work. And this was a family of seven altogether. I had mum, dad, two brothers and two sisters. I was the second eldest.
So had he had much of an education, your father?
Hardly any at all.
And how about you?
Oh, I went to grammar school in Bradford. But wasted a lot of it. Came out with just four GCSEs. And I can't say that I enjoyed school life at all. Being more orientated towards the outdoors, you know, the cricket and football, rather than geography and history. But some of it was quite boring and, I think, badly presented. In fact, the highlight of 5 years at grammar school was the day that school burnt down. I was on my way to school one morning and there were some of the lads were coming away from school and I said, what's going on? Well, the school's burnt down. Now, the only benefit that that gave us was we only got one day off because they rehoused us the following day. Bradford Education Authority was so efficient that they managed to fit us into a school that had been derelict for a few years. So, you know, one day for a school burning down is not enough.
That's patently unfair, isn't it?
Yes.
So did you do other things outdoors, such as climbing, sailing?
We did a lot of hiking. Not whilst I was at school, that came later. I played football, I played cricket for school, played cricket for house and that sort of thing, but it was all outside school. We were like villains because we used to find any plot of land we could to play cricket and football, including nearby school playgrounds, and we were chased off more than once by the police, but there could be something like 50 of us playing a game of football all at the same time. It was Sunday afternoon. It was gorgeous, you know. There was a piece of land directly in front of the house that we lived in that was owned by the Education Authority to produce school meals. And, of course, at weekend they didn't work, so at weekends, all the lads from the street were on this piece of land. It was tarmacked. But to get there, we had to slide through the railings at the bottom of the garden or climb over the spikes at the top. My mother's heart used to be in her mouth most of the time, seeing us leap over these railings, which were on the other side. There was about a 6-7 foot drop. But as kids, it didn't bother us. We just went, you know, and that was it. But we enjoyed our time, I must admit.
So what happened to you when you left school, Alan?
When I left school...
Age?
I was 16. I wasn't armed because I hadn't got the results. I left school in July. and it was August when the results came out. But in the meantime, I'd been interviewed by the Deputy Director for Education in Bradford, and he said, right, you've got a job, subject to you getting maths and English in your GCSEs. Turned out I got maths, English, French and German, so by the time the results came out, I was confirmed. I was placed in the general office, and I'll always have an abiding memory of an office in the early 1950s, because my duties were concerned with making the tea, washing up afterwards, stoking the fire, getting it lit, running round from one department to another and the typing pool to get letters typed, putting stamps on envelopes towards the end of the day, sitting on a high stool, no back to it, and the desk in front of me was the old-fashioned sloping desk, and doing any bits of paperwork that I was allowed to do at that time. At 18, it was time for me to do national service. I was 18 in the March, and I waited a couple of months and nothing had happened. I was getting a bit fed up with the way things were in the office. So I rang the, whoever it was, about being called up, and I actually went into the RAF in September.
Had they forgotten you?
No, I don't think so. It was just that there was probably a glut. These were post-war years, and they were very busy. The first thing that I was called to do was to have a medical, which was a sham, really, but they looked at me and said, you know, cough and you're A1, you're in. And then I had to report to Cardington, which was the recruitment point, given the uniforms, and then moved on to West Kirby for square bashing, then on to trade training. And it was in trade training where one day the corporal came to me and said, you're going for a Morse test. And I was the only one out of the whole of our flight that was told to do this. So I just went, listened to the dots and dashes, and came away. Nobody said a darn thing. Until after square bashing, I was sent to Compton Bassett, where wireless operators are trained.
So do you think they'd spotted something in you?
Well, they must have done. I must have recognised some of the sounds that were given to me during this particular test, which lasted only about 15, 20 minutes anyway. you know what the forces are like. Anyway, 16 weeks at Compton Bassett. And then, for the life of me, Chris, I can't remember where I moved on to from there. I think it was Bertram Newton in Norfolk. And that was just a listening station. And it was whilst I was there, I'd been there all that long, when the flight sergeant came into the billet. During the night, it must have been 1 or 2 o'clock during the night, and said, you and you, get out of bed, get packed, you're off. No idea where. So four of us packed. Eventually, three of us went to Malta and one to Cyprus, and this was at the point where the Suez crisis was on. We were shuffled around all over the Midlands for a day or two, because I think there were several staging points. And eventually, we, the three of us, ended up in Southampton. And we got on a Sunderland flying boat. And from there, from Southampton Water, we flew to Malta. Now, the purpose of the job in Malta was simply to listen, really, about to the aircraft. This was at a time when the Vulcans were really flying over Egypt. And I think at one point there was a mission by the Vulcans to bomb Cairo or somewhere in Egypt. And we were instructed to call them back. I think this must have been at a time when Anthony Eden decided that, you know, it's over. They've capitulated. The canal is now open. Or it would be open as soon as they cleared all the debris from it. So the thing stopped. Now, as far as I was concerned, the work aspect of the posting to Malta was quite unimportant. Yeah, I was only a lad of 18 years old, and football was at the top of my mind. And because we were in the Mediterranean, swimming was very important to us as well. And almost every afternoon, we would get in the gharry and go down to the beach, and we'd swim in the sea for an hour or two and then come back and maybe have a game of football or something like that. But I saw those 4 months more as a holiday than anything else. But I was quite proud in later years to think that I'd been part of something that was important for my country, you know.
Well, it sounds like you actually finished. You stopped the Suez War.
No, well, not me personally. Nothing like that.
Or sent a message and stopped it.
I was just there with thousands of others doing what I had to do. I mean, the system was you only did a 4-hour watch each day, so there's another 20 hours to fill in apart from sleeping. And we did it because we had a football pitch and we had to get down to the beach easy.
So were you in any way consciously trying to improve your more skills, your radio, hone your radio?
All the time. I reckoned by the time I'd finished trade training at Compton Bassett that I had a fairly good aptitude for Morse and reading messages and sending messages, and I was quite proud of that. Even today, I can remember the Morse code. It's not something that I've forgotten.
No.
Anyway, we finally came home from Malta, and I was posted to Preston. And again, that was a sort of listening job.
So when you say listening, what were you listening to, them or
well,
us?
We were given a frequency, and we sat there for a few hours waiting, perhaps, for any signal that came up on that frequency. The signals would come, if they did happen, from aircraft like the old Shackletons and things like that, asking for any sort of information, what their position was, what the local weather was, something like that. I suppose in many ways, at the level that we were operating, we didn't really know what the bigger picture was. We just sat there, took a message, and there was a sergeant in the office next door, and you gave him the message, and that was the end of the job. You'd no idea what it was all about. There was never, to my memory, any message went back to the same aircraft. It was just receiving perhaps these days it was called intelligence, but I don't
it
know.
It does sound a bit like GCHQ or the early...
Yeah, it's something like that. I think these places were dotted all around the UK, actually, because in those days there was still the, I suppose, the Cold War, the Russian threat.
Absolutely. So, still, Cuba hadn't happened yet, had it?
That's right. So, you know, we had to be there. And it eventually saw my time out at the end of the 2 years national service.
So then, presumably, you had to make a decision about what to do next.
Yeah, well, when I came out of the RAF, I didn't really want to go back to the education office where I was before I did national service. So I got a job at a local steelworks because the money was better. We were only talking about £8 a week, something like that. And that lasted for just about 1 year until the day the Progress Office manager said, Alan, I want to see you, along with two other people working there, and said, look, I'm very, very sorry. There is currently a recession in the steel industry, and you've got to go. You are now redundant. So I went home that day and started to wonder what I'd do next. It just so happened that we had a neighbour living almost next door who was keen on reading Sunday papers. And it was easy for us, and they never minded that we just popped in and said, hello, you know, how's things going? And there he'd be on the floor with his newspapers open. And we'd do this for popping several times over a few weeks. And eventually he said to me, hey, Alan, this looks interesting. The Falkland Islands dependencies are looking for wireless operator mechanics. I said, oh, that sounds good. Now, the first thing I've got to admit is that my geography is absolutely terrible at that time. Well, since I didn't have a job, I thought, we'll have a go at this. Got a letter off, got a response back. Please turn up in an address in...
Millbank?
Millbank was one. That was for the interview. And Wimpole Street for a medical, if I'm not mistaken. You're bringing it all back now, Chris. I'm grateful.
So you'll be interviewed first?
Yes, and then the medical. And then nothing happened until I got a letter that said, please report to Southampton at a date in September 1958. You're off.
What, if anything, I appreciate it's a long time ago, what, if anything, do you remember of the interview?
It was rubbish. Because I was... Now, 1958. It was at least 12 months since I'd left the RAF. This interview couldn't have lasted more than 10 minutes, during which I had a Morse key in front of me and I was asked to send a message. And by that time, my Morse was so rusty that it was unbelievable. It's hardly readable. But I persevered. I sent whatever message it was, and they seemed to like it. And that was it. Nothing more to it.
Do you remember who was
they behind? Must have been desperate.
No, I can confirm that they were.
Right.
Yeah, at that time. Do you remember who was behind the other side of the table? Frank Elliott?
No, that doesn't ring a bell.
Right. Ray Ady?
Now, Ray Ady was a geologist surveyor.
Yeah.
I didn't know the man, but I knew his name, and he was quite popular for some reason, but I don't know what.
Oh, Bill Sloman was your name.
Bill Sloman was even more popular. I think that was the gentleman that I might have been involved with during the interview. Mm.
Do you remember them sussing you out psychologically at all?
No, not a bit. In fact, I don't think that happened until I was on the Bisco. My mother and one of my sisters decided that they wanted to see me off. So we had a train down to Southampton, and I put them into bed and breakfast accommodation, then went straight on to the Bisco. The following day was the day we sailed. Now, there was a tall Foster. Is that a name you know? Right, can't remember what his Christian name was, but he was there, and I think that he had something to do with the FIDS head office or whatever it was in London. One of the purposes of the sailing south, I think, was to find out whether just what these lads were, including me, and how they fit together. I was 21 years old, and I think I might well have been the youngest. And I can remember that I was mostly quiet and reserved, but I've always been a good listener, so I could always enjoy the jokes and the conversations and the debates that were going on the ship. I shared a cabin with another FID, wore glasses, curly hair. He was going further south than me, but again, I can't remember his name, who sort of took me under his wing, because I'm fairly sure he may well have been south before. Now, I think this chap, Mr. Foster, was assessing me, because at one point during the trip, he came and sat with me and said, "Alan, are you okay?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm fine." And that was more or less the conversation I had with him. But I got the impression afterwards that why did he come and ask me? And I realised it was because I wasn't in the crowd. I wasn't really out of it or on the fringe of it. I was quite enjoying everything because this was absolutely brand new experience for me. The trouble was that the weather kept getting nice and warm and then hot. Even when we got down to Montevideo, which we were there 1 or 2 days, it was still nice and warm, but from there down towards Stanley it began to cool down. Now, eventually we ended up at Stanley, and that's where we were issued with our polar kit. We also were invited to the Governor's House for an at-home, which we all enjoyed, I suppose. But my abiding memory of Port Stanley was it was a smallish town of mainly timber houses, one jetty, the SS Great Britain parked off a bit. And then when 1983 came round and the Falkland shindig came up, I thought, what the heck is all the fuss about? People are thinking Port Stanley is some great city. which it wasn't. I mean, by then it could have expanded considerably, but I doubt very much, because the population is spread. Although there's a concentration on the in Stanley, most of it is spread over the islands anyway. Anyway,
that was the year, of course, when most other people worked out where the Falklands were. At what point did you work out where the Falklands were?
I didn't actually. I still no idea.
So you sailed them, and
I'm going to cut a corner here. It wasn't until I saw the first iceberg that I said to myself, "Oh mother, what have I done?" that's honest. I had no idea. But, you know, I suppose I've committed, and that was it.
So you didn't know you were going to a snowy...
No idea.
...environment.
No idea. From Stanley, we went across to South Georgia for a few days and then came back to Stanley, and then the Bisco took us south, starting... First port of call, as I remember, was Deception. And from there, we called at... I can remember Hope Bay, I can remember Port Lacroix before we got to the Argentine Islands. And it was when the Bisco sailed at the end of the summer, having dropped off all the rest of her cargo, that I stood at the back door of the hut and I cried. I still felt, Mum, I've done it now. But that was the beginning of 3 years of total enjoyment. I really enjoyed those 3 years. Just like, in fact, I enjoyed most of my national service anyway. You just get into it and do it, and that was great.
One more question on what we've covered already. Did you at any time brush up your Morse?
No. Not till I got there. There was no opportunity to do that. It would have been nice to have had a bit of practice on the ship, but I think the crew discipline on the Bisco was a bit more strict than it was, say, on the Shackleton. We hardly ever saw the radio officer. So I waited until we were... in the Argentine Islands, and I was taken over from Ted Clapp. Now, Ted was ex-Merchant Navy, as I recall, and he was extremely patient. One of the problems I had was, although I could brush up on my Morse, and Ted put me onto schedules with Port Stanley for weather reports and that sort of thing almost straight away. So everything was brushing up nicely from that side. My big problem, a really big problem that frightened me somewhat, was that I had two RCA receivers and a great big ET4336 transmitter. It stood about 5 feet high. And I said to Ted, if anything goes wrong with these, I've no idea what to do. And he said, well, just keep your fingers crossed. And if something goes wrong, at the end of the year, you can always ask for a complete replacement unit. During the year, the first year, some things did go wrong, but I was blessed with two physicists on the base, Chris Horton and Harry Agger. And if there was something, I would always try to fix things myself if I could, but if that didn't happen, I would ask Chris or Harry if they would come and have a look at something and share their thoughts with me until we got it right. And it was a system that worked for me. And I gained a fair amount of confidence in... I'll put it the other way around. I stopped worrying too much about the way things were were going.
But if your Morse was, by your own admission, rusty, does that make those first few messages to Stanley a bit suspect?
Yes. Yeah, the messages, the initial messages, were more groups of five numbers, digits.
Codes.
Because they were the weather codes. The Argentine Islands was a scientific station. It wasn't a sledging station. Everything there, we had four or five meteorological chaps on the base taking observations at very regular intervals. Then they coded them up, passed them into the WOT office, and I was the one that was responsible for sending them back to Stanley. So the first thing I did in brushing up was with numbers, and the actual procedure for sending messages was not a problem anyway, because I could remember that fairly easily from my RAF days. During the first month or so, I think Ted did the plain language Morse sending, until he probably felt that I was ready to do it. And I eased into it fairly easy. So, again, there was no problem. One of the things about wireless operators is that they all have their own style. They all have what's called a fist. And you can actually tell who's sending you a message by the fist by the way he operates on the key. For example, John Cheek, who was the Hope Bay operator, he had a special Morse key, which I think was a sideswiper, where the rest of us went up and down. And John could send Morse at something like between 30 and 40 words a minute. My best was about 20, 25, but that was good for the rest of, compared to the rest of the wireless operators down there. Some of the others, you could tell, when you send your weather obs to Stanley, you sort of, or any other plain language signals, when you're actually listening and to either the base operators or Stanley, you can usually tell who was on the key. I mean, some of these bases only had one operator anyway. But if you'd only just broken into a message that was being sent, and so you didn't know the call sign, you could still guess who it was that was saying, "Well, that's Barry at Base G, or so John at Hope Bay."
Would you have been aware of your own style, your own signature?
I thought mine was good. I thought it was as good as anybody's, if not better, because I think as time went on, I developed my own style, and I always tried to make it as clear as I possibly could, and there was a reason for that, because once Ted had gone, I was the only WT operator on the base, which meant I was there 7 days a week for the rest of the year, with virtually no relief. Now, because we were scientific, there were weather ops going in three or four times a day, and then there was the ordinary signal stuff that had to be dealt with as well, incoming and outgoing. There were the newsletters that we were receiving. There were greetings, telegrams that people were sending to families and friends. And I was very fortunate because without asking, two of the weathermen volunteered to send the occasional obs for me. Now, that meant that I could have a couple of hours off, which was gratefully received. Their Morse was crude and basic, but they were very brave. They could tune the transmitter, they could get the right frequency on the receiver, they could waffle their way through the Morse code and get the obs off with not too much difficulty, actually. So, if they needed any tuition on the Morse code itself, I'm quite willing to help them with it.
This sounds like it was a staffing problem then. If you were the only person on the base who could really do Morse, you were tied to your desk.
I was. Yeah.
360 That's days right. a year.
Yeah. That was certainly the case in the first year. Maybe someone learned the lesson at the end of that, because I was blessed with a second operator in the second and third years that I was down there. In the second year, Fraser, I can't remember his surname, he was a Scot, only a small chap. We gave him a nickname, we just called him Och. He joined me, and we used to, it became too easy then. I think we worked week on, week off, it was a super system. In the third year, it was Tony, an Irishman, very nice lad. Again, we shared the week on, week off.
Fraser White,
that's him.
With a Y.
Yeah.
In the third year, which is 62.
Tony.
Well, there's a C. Wade.
No. Can you look at the year before that? 61. I was there, the full years I was there were 59, 60 and 61.
Well, 61 was F. Fraser White. So 60...
Perhaps Tony was there the year before.
60 was J. A. Quinn.
That's it, Tony Quinn.
Yeah.
He's the one. I got them the wrong way around, sorry, Chris.
Oh, don't worry, that's okay. So life got easier.
Indeed it did. But, I mean, apart from being a wireless operator, which is a primary job, you had other things to do as well, because everything was a set of things like emptying the loo and getting rid of the gash and giving the cook a day off on Sunday so you did the cooking when it was your turn, cleaning the living room and stuff like that. One of the relationships I developed was with Bob Harkness, who was the diesel engineer. Bell. The first year, 59.
I'm looking in Fuchs's Mice and Men. K.R. Bell.
Keith Bell, that's right.
Who was basically 59.
And he was a diesel engineer as well. And it was during that year Keith came to me and said, Alan, we've just appointed you as the base electrician. whatever radio had to do with
electric.
Standard electrics, I don't know. But I rewired that up during that year. And Keith supervised me, but he was quite pleased with the work that I did.
Well, certainly in that first job, were you doing 3 hourly obs? How many wet met signals did you send per day? Was it combined?
Now, there'd be one at 9, one at 2, and another one in the early evening. There might have been one late evening, I'm not sure. 3 or 4.
So you're sending signals 3 or 4 times a day?
Yeah. And one of the jobs that was done every day by the Met people was they would send up a radio sonde balloon, receive the signal, and that ended up in quite a large numerical signal, coded signal, that had to go back to Stanley.
This all sounds rather tedious, Alan. You said earlier it was the most exciting time of your life.
Well, it was, because there was more to it than just operating the radio. There was that time in between skeds. There was the time when Tony or Fraser were doing the radio and I could do something else. I mean, we had 2 boats, for instance, 2 small boats, 1 little pram. The Galindi's Island itself was set almost in the centre of a group of smaller, very small islands, and in summer, the sea was just like glass, barely a ripple on it. And it was absolutely gorgeous to row around some of the islands. Never going too far away, just round one island or two and back again. It was wonderful. Except for the time when we were happily rowing along, perhaps two of us, me and maybe Bobo, one of the others in the boat, and suddenly this hump comes up in front of the boat. What kind of whale it was, I'll never know, but it frightened me for a few minutes. And then, again, during winter, I can remember, and this was in my first year, Barry Shaw was given responsibility for measuring the thickness of the sea ice. The only thing was, he was so keen to do the job that he went out too early on the ice, and I was designated to help him. I would do the writing, he would do the measuring. Mm-hmm. And he had this big drill. Hang on, stop here, Alan. We'll take a measurement here. And he puts the drill in. Went straight through. He said, we're a bit on thin ice here. We were both on skis, mind. You better back off a bit. So we did. Right the way back to the island. We weren't going to waste any more time out there. And we waited another week or two before the ice thickened up and carried on. I can remember also the day that in summer when I was sitting on the rocks right on the coast of the island just watching seals on floes just gliding past. And suddenly there was a disturbance in the water. And it was a pod of killer whales. And they couldn't have been more than 20 feet from where I was sat. Fortunately, I was quite high on the rocks. But to see this massive fin break the water and go down again with three or four other killer whales alongside. And all they did was just going past. They were en route somewhere. But it was a wonderful sight, something never to be forgotten. And then there was the day, back to winter. I think it would be in the second or third year, when there were two aircraft based at Deception Island, a beaver and an otter. And if I'm not mistaken, they were to assist with setting up a base further south. It could have been Marguerite Bay, I'm not sure. I don't think it was Fossil Bluff. Anyway, it was decided that the beaver would visit us, and on its way, hopefully south, and we were to determine a flat piece of sea ice for it to land on. Well, off goes our base leader with a troop and decides that there is a nice flat piece just off the island. There's a channel between our island and the next one over, and it was only about up to 100 yards wide. The beaver finally arrived, landed on the ice. Now, what everybody had forgotten, because this was winter, was that in that channel there was a rock. It was we called it locally channel rock. But you couldn't see it because it was covered. And the ice round it, because of the tides, was weak. One of the skis on landing of the beaver went under, followed by quite a piece of the fuselage. And the most we could do was to unload it as fast as we could, because we were all gathered there on the ice to watch this anyway, and get the people out and get them to safety and leave the aeroplane to its own devices. And that's what happened. It stayed there with the tail sticking up for months until we eventually pushed it under, because we couldn't stand the sight of it any longer. And that was another episode.
Was there any sense of I mean, the loss of one aeroplane is quite serious in the Antarctic, so were you aware of the seriousness of that accident?
Oh, yeah, very serious. It stopped the Otter from making any move for some considerable time. And
because you couldn't have one plane?
Oh, no, there had to be a backup. It's like we were saying at the beginning, you know, you don't have one, you have two for everything. But the pilots were, you know, very sanguine about it, I suppose. You know, they had to accept this and that.
Do you remember who the pilots were?
Well, I can't remember the name of the pilot of the Beaver, but the Otter was a flight lieutenant, Lord.
Ron Lord.
Ron Lord, yeah. I don't know who the one was. Mm. There's quite a difference between the two characters, actually.
How do you mean?
Well, Ron Lord was one of the lads, from my memory. The other one, he had, how shall I say, I think, I felt he was, he had rank. He was a bit superior to everybody else. That may not have been the way anybody else saw him, but it's the way I saw him. So, of course, he had to stay with us until such time as we could get him out, which happened to be some months further on.
Somebody called English?
Could have been. But I don't really remember, Chris, no, I'm sorry.
Fair enough. Was Bob Bond the following year?
No.
No. Don't worry, it doesn't matter.
Mm. Mm.
So were you able to rescue anything else from this plane? I mean,
No, that was it. We got out what we could at the time, because the pilot, whoever he was, didn't want seawater in any of his equipment. So what could be ripped out was ripped out before the sea claimed it.
Yeah.
And that was it. We got all his personal gear out, because that was loose stowed anyway. Mm. But the some of the equipment was sealed in, and we just got what we could. What a day that was.
And, of course, you had extra people on base then.
Yeah. And I suppose the strange thing about it all was that nobody felt as though it was like nowadays a car crash. You'd all stand around there worried about everything. You know, it was something that just happened. Mm. And we all walked away from it. Nothing we could do. I mean, what were we? All young lads anyway. No females in those days, of course.
You said at the beginning that you were almost tearful when you realised what you'd let yourself in for. At what point in the process in your first year did that kind of go away and the excitement take over?
Oh, I think it was within weeks of landing at the base. There was too much to do initially anyway, because the BISCO, I mean, you'll have heard this before anyway, the first thing it does is land supplies for a year or more. So it's all hands to the pump. You do nothing more than put a box on your back and trail it up to the hut and get it into storage. Hundreds and hundreds of them. It took days and days and days. You just got into the work, and I forgot Mum. Just got stuck in, because I'd not only got that, along with all the other lads on the base, of course, but I got to learn what was going on in the radio cabin as well. So time was filled. Not much time for sleeping, I'm afraid, because one of the things we had to do was to identify which boxes had got any glass bottles in them, because there was every likelihood that if there was a frost overnight, which there would be, those bottles could break. And that meant that we'd be out of vinegar or some whatever was in the bottles. Certainly no champagne, and beer was in cans. So it was fairly early on when I realised that there was nothing to worry about. I think I was getting to grips with the job. I was still a bit worried about the job itself, but not homesick anymore. These lads got on ever so well together from the word go. There were no cliques, there was no acrimony, there was no disliking anybody. We were just a group of lads, you know, all doing different things. But normally it was in the evening, after the evening meal, when we came together into the living room and talked or listened to music. Or read books, because we had a fairly good library. That's when Shackleton became my hero, actually. We had two doctors initially, Alex and Colin. Both were second lieutenants in the RAMC, if I'm not mistaken. Colin moved on after a while, but Alex stayed with us. And he, along with one of the meteorologists, Jeff Rowe, who I understand was killed in a motorcycle accident, he's a great friend of Barry Shaw, were forever provoking some kind of debate.
Alex Cummings?
Cummings, that's the one. Yeah, he's a great fella. Scott, I think, had a home on the Western Isles somewhere. Very sympathetic. That was one of the things that they did. It was awful for doctors. They used to conduct these physiological experiments. You stuck your hand in a bucket of iced water and kept it there for 20 minutes. By the time your hand came out, it just wasn't my hand at all, you know, it was someone else's. Or you wore what looked like a string vest, but it wasn't. It was wires, you know, meshed wires all the way front and back. It was a damn cold thing attached to some kind of temperature gadget, and the doctor would come up every now and again and take the temperature of this thing. Looking at body warmth, I suppose.
Was this a voluntary participation on your behalf, or did he have not much choice?
No. The doctor said, Alan, you're going to do it. and that was me volunteering, if you like to put it that way.
Yeah.
But, we just took it in our stride.
You had these debates, so what sort of subjects would you debate?
Well, I remember one particular one, Jeff and Alec, arguing about selfishness. And even Alec, or one of them, was saying that even Jesus Christ was selfish. Now, I suppose he was referring to the day that Christ took the whip to the moneylenders, because he regarded the place where they were lending money as being holy ground. And this was an argument Martin joined in. Frankly, I just listened. But I was absolutely thrilled to listen to all these different sides to one argument.
Was it erudite conversation?
Oh, yes, very much so. And there must have been five or six of them involved with their own sides to the argument, which turned out to be absolutely inconclusive at the end, because it was really just a matter of everyone having their own opinion of it anyway. But I must remember, I do remember, that it was significant to me. It just stuck in my memory, because only a week or so ago, I had an email from Doncaster Council, which was concerned with the behaviour of district council and parish council members. And they're exhorted to abide by what's called the Nolan Principles in public life. You know, one thing or another, honesty, integrity. And one of the Nolan Principles was selflessness. And for the life of me, I cannot imagine anybody being selfless, except on occasion. But there's no way that they can conduct their entire lives being completely selfless. It can't be done, in my opinion. but it when I read this document, I thought, crikey, you know, Alex, I remember that argument now. But there were other things that they talked about.
Well, were there things they didn't talk about? Interestingly, religion was frequently taboo on basis for obvious reasons. Were there?
I've got a feeling that was ignored, that they didn't bother. Same with politics. They didn't bother with that. They talked a lot about music.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were... I suppose, I wouldn't actually call them highbrow, but certainly some of the lads down there gave me an introduction to some of the classics, the popular classics, and I ended up in buying quite a lot of LPs from Stanley in the second and third year, so that I could play them privately in the WT office. And there was always someone with a record player somewhere in the hut that would play music. And one of the things that I used to really enjoy was Albert Schweitzer playing Bach. And I don't know how I came to do that, but I just enjoy organ music. For me, it's a sound.
Albert Schweitzer?
Yeah.
The missionary?
Yes.
Play the organ, I didn't know that. Okay. Were you taking part in these discussions? You mentioned earlier that you...
No, I was more on the edge.
You were reserved. Did you come out of your shell at all?
Not really, because that's the kind of person that I was. But I was certainly listening. I was certainly taking it all in. I was certainly, I suppose, forming private opinions about what was being said, but I suppose what I am saying, Chris, is that I'm not a particularly good mixer. I'm okay one to one. I'm okay one to another two. If you take a crowd, I'm quiet. I'd rather listen. And I am a good listener. I'm not one of these people who lets things float just past me. I listen to what people say to me. Or what say to each other. I've always described myself as, well, since that time actually, as being a sort of observer on people's behaviour. I like to see the body language. I like to hear what they have to say. Not that it means too much, but it tells me something at the time, I suppose.
You served under three different base leaders.
Yes.
So what were your observations about being a base leader? Did you spot good trends and poor trends?
Well, the first one, Keith Bell, I was too inexperienced to make any judgment about him. Until the day that he came and said, "Alan, you're the electrician." And I thought, well, he must think something about me if it's not just the fact that I deal in electrical or electronic equipment. And since I did a job without having to go back to ask him for advice too many times, I felt at the end of it, you know, his confidence in me was perhaps justified. Second year, Mr. Murray, he, nice enough chap, surveyor, had difficulty making my mind up about him. I think he... I just can't form any opinion about that. I remember him well. I remember his joviality. I remember the way he got on easily with people, including me. But I don't remember having too much contact with him, even though we were close-knit community. Third year was Bob Harkness, and I can remember one feeling quite early on in that year, that having had 2 years' experience, that I hadn't been approached to be base leader in the third year. It was a temporary thing, because when Bob came, you know, he was a super fella, and we got on extremely well together. And I had every confidence in him being the base leader. And certainly I never felt an ounce of jealousy about the job he was doing. In fact, I suppose in the end I was grateful that that I didn't get the job. So that was that.
Were there tensions from time to time?
Yes. Now then, second year... third year, the doctor and I didn't hit it off. It wasn't Colin and it wasn't Alex, it was the third doctor. This would be 1961, I think, Chris.
Interestingly, there's no mention of him. I've noticed before now that they leave people out who didn't quite fit.
I don't like the way you said that.
Well, you're in here. There's no medical officer mentioned at all.
Oh.
In 61.
What hours. About 60? Were the medical officers there?
Spark.
That's him.
B.R. Spark.
Brian, yeah. It must have been 60 then.
Right.
Sorry if I can't get the year right.
No, it's not a problem at all. That's what this book's useful for.
Yeah. Brian had a habit of wherever he went, inside or outside the hut, he always left the door open. Always. Now, my WT office was the end room quite next door to the door that went outside. And I suffered Brian long enough. And one day I got so angry that once again he left the door open. He'd gone to feed the dogs, which were about 50 yards away. And when he came back, I'd locked the door. And he banged on the door and I took no damn notice. So he was forced to walk the whole way around to the other end of the hut to come in, which he did, and brought a snowball with him, which he cracked on my head. Well, I retaliated fairly meekly, I suppose. Sat there fuming for a while, and I thought, you know, this ain't going to go on. And I went down to where he had his little room and surgery and knocked on the door and shouted, come in. I opened the door, went in, closed the door. I said, look, Brian, this has got to stop. I said, you know, you don't realise just how cold it can get up that end of the hut. And that's when Brian admitted that he'd got a fault. And we apologised to each other. Unfortunately, that was the end of the matter, because from then on, Brian closed the door. And I thought, great. And we were good friends after that. In fact, I was out skiing one day, learning to ski, fell over, and we had these big mittens on our hands. And when I got up, I felt something was wrong. And when I took the mitten off, this thumb was back here. It was completely dislocated. No blood, no pain. It was just so cold. I went back to the hut. I said, Brian, look at this. Can you do anything with this? The first thing he did was he gets a book out. What was his book? He could see his mind work. How do I do this? How do I do this? And he said, yeah, I can fix that, Alan. And he said, stand behind me, which I did. Right, put your hand underneath my arm, between my arm and your body, which I did. So this was so I couldn't see what was going to happen. He said, right, you ready? He said, yeah. I said, it's cold anyway, I can't feel a thing, Brian. So he yanked it, turned it, put it back. Bob's your uncle, it was done. It was quite funny, actually.
Did it hurt when it warmed up?
No, it didn't. Not a bit. I never had any after effects, except that I feel sometimes that this knuckle is not quite where it ought to be. But it's not given me a problem in later life. Wonderful.
Let's pause for a moment and continue in a moment's time.
Sure.